TFM.
Fun will now commence.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Journey, our dedicated Star Trek Voyager podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, you know I have eye problems for years now, and I'm seeing double today. I'm not sure which is the real you, so if you can do me a favor and just make sure that you're facing the right direction, that'll really help me out.
Oh, I thought you had that double vision, you know, so...
I think this podcast is going to have the most robust soundtrack of any of the shows we've ever done on the network.
Well,
right?
You know, Voyager just leans in. And, you know, we all know Tom Paris was a huge fan of the 20th Century.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure he was a big fan of that song, too, if you would have played for him on his jukebox. So,
I'm sure he'd have a real kick-ass sound system in his car, right?
You'd have everybody being like, I can hear the bass through the deck, which is so insulated, it shouldn't even be possible. Can you please turn down the Led Zeppelin?
That's right. You thought Harry's clarinet was annoying.
Oh, yeah. Tom rocking out again.
All right, everyone. We are going to continue our 30th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Voyager today with episode 2 of season 1. It's Parallax, and here is a very quick rundown of the story. Caught in a galactic escape room, the newly merged Starfleet and Maquis crews must work together to find a way out while fighting with each other. Meanwhile, the Doctor experiences shrinkage, and Neelix does wonderful things with vegetables. Can Voyager become one big happy family and continue making their way home, or will they remain trapped inside the event horizon of a quantum singularity forever? All right, Matthew, prediction. Are they going to get out, or are they going to stay stuck in the singularity in the second episode of the new series?
I don't know. I think they're going to get out. I think it's going to be fine.
I think so. All right. But to get out, they have to work together. And that's really the core of this story. In terms of the characters, it's two as a crowd, two people and two crews. Maybe first we could just talk about the crews themselves, since there's so many people involved. Early in the episode, we've got Maquis coming up to Chakotay and letting him know that if he wants to take over the ship, they're there for him. But he quickly shuts that down. So what are your thoughts on this element of the series concept, which is so important that these two crews are going to have trouble getting along with one another. But yet, from a writing standpoint, it's sort of a delicate balancing act. But this isn't Battlestar Galactica. It's Star Trek. And so what do you think about what they're doing here with the characters?
You know, I mean, this is the thing that obviously became a huge point of contention basically after Battlestar came out, right? Mm-hmm. People,
which was long after this, of course.
Yes. Yeah. And in many ways, Ronald D. Moore's Battlestar Galactica is actually kind of in response to his time on Star Trek. Specifically, I think what he saw Star Trek become in Star Trek Voyager after Deep Space Nine, and the places where he felt held back, right, by the structures of the storytelling that were put in place, which he thought, I think, in some ways were sometimes too arbitrary and missed out on storytelling opportunities. I think it's interesting because I love the idea that Chakotay is on board and totally understands the reason why he needs to be the best first officer that he can be. Also be there to make sure that the Maquis crew are not forgotten and not overlooked. And I think the response of the other Maquis to this situation feels very true, rings very true, especially for people who have a bone to pick with Starfleet and, mm-hmm. and the ways in which they have felt kind of abandoned by the Federation because of what happened with the Cardassians. Now, obviously, the most interesting thing is that these people were Federation citizens before they became part of the Maquis. So mm-hmm. there is a lot in which they would still have in common. But there's also a lot of their experience that could make this a tumultuous marriage, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think a little background reading that I was doing where they talked about this idea that they were going to bring these crews together and they basically didn't want this to drag on for too long because they mm-hmm. thought that that would become frustrating to the audience. Mm. I see what they're saying, but I also feel like you're actually missing good story opportunities mm-hmm. and you're cutting the legs out from under your story before it even really has a chance to get started. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like they limited themselves for no good reason, because honestly, this is really the best part of this episode. These two crews that find themselves stuck into the middle of nowhere Delta Quadrant with the distinct possibility that they will never return home. Mm-hmm. And they're on a ship where they have no ability to just go to the next starbase and get help, which this episode is also about. And I think what kind of happens is, in some ways, with some of the storytelling and the way that they kind of rein themselves in, hits an easy button, yeah. which allows them to just basically, this is Star Trek Voyager, the next generation. Mm-hmm. And instead of truly exploring, okay, this show is Star Trek Voyager. We're stuck in the Delta Quadrant. Mm-hmm. How does this show stand apart and do things that only Star Trek Voyager could do that the next generation, Deep Space Nine, the original series couldn't do? And yeah. that's something we've talked a lot about, you know, obviously, as we've been doing the rewatch with Deep Space Nine, in those places where, like, does this feel like an episode that just could have taken place in any old Star Trek series, especially yeah. Next Generation?
Especially in season one, where they exactly. feel like they're bridging from TNG to DS9, right? Yeah.
And the places where this episode leans into the things that only Voyager can do is where it's at its best. Mm-hmm. You know, where you have the two crews kind of struggling to get together. You have the personality conflict issues of people who haven't been in Starfleet. They don't understand the regulations. They mm-hmm. haven't, you know, they haven't spent, my wife and I were just watching, the Next Generation episode where, Wesley, it's his first time to take the test for the Academy.
Oh, right. Yeah. Coming of age. Yeah.
And obviously, he's, what, almost 16 years old. So these people who go to the Academy, they're around 16, 17 years old, and then they graduate, you know, in their 20s. And so they have been indoctrinated with all that it means to be a part of Starfleet. So to have a lot of these Maquis crew members come in who may have never been in that experience, this is going to be a huge obstacle for them to overcome. And that creates great storytelling opportunities. And again, as they lean into that with the, you know, the dynamic between Chakotay and Janeway, the dynamics then between B'Elanna and what's going on there with Carrie and engineering, with the other Maquis crew members, with the way even Carrie Kim is kind of talking about this, because this is his first post and it's just so exciting, all the gossip on the ship, you know, like all of that, I think, is really fascinating. And again, It's one of those things where when this episode leans into that, I think it's actually at its best.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned the easy button. This was about the same time that the easy button commercials were on TV, wasn't it?
Probably. I feel like that whole campaign has been around forever.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so, yeah.
I can still see the commercials though. But so, yeah, like, the conflict within the crew, if it had gone on for 7 seasons, that would have become tedious, yes, because that's not what I watch Star Trek for. I don't just want to see conflict all the time. But I think some level of conflict is important for storytelling because that's the real world. And in the case of Voyager, I feel like they move away from the conflict far too quickly. They could have had that drag on at least through the first season and the crew jails, because I think the crew is going to jail eventually. They kind of have to. It's exactly. A small ship. There aren't that many people on the ship. It would be hard to just be at each other's throats for a long period of time. But realistically, I think, you know, you would be talking months at least, if not a year together before people really settle in and accept the reality of the situation that they're in. I think it's also helpful when you think about Voyager to put yourself in the shoes of the people on the ship instead of looking at it just from the fan viewer perspective, because we know it's a Star Trek series, so we know they're going to get back, but they don't know that. If you were in that situation, you'd probably feel like the chances of me ever getting back to Earth are very, very small, right? We're probably not going to get back. It's just too far. It takes too long. So many things could happen. So as a viewer, though, Matthew, did you ever think that they might not get Voyager back home by the end of the series and they would leave the ship stranded somewhere?
I mean, I always suspected that they would find some way to get home at some point, and that most likely it probably would happen by the end, you know, mainly because the whole crux of the show is the journey, the struggle, you know?
Right.
And I think I completely agree with what you said when you were talking about the idea that, you know, this is a thematic element that could have just run through like the first season. So the whole first season really is about as they struggle in a place that they know nothing about, they have no connection to, they're also struggling to come together. And that so each story in that season then helps build the relationships between different crew members as it happens in this episode. Again, you know, I think that's one of the great things about this episode is that you see the dynamic between Chakotay and Janeway as they're learning to trust one another. And I think that dynamic could have been interesting for that to kind of continue a little bit more throughout the season with B'Elanna, of course. And, you know, obviously, too, you know, you've already seen the ways in which the show is having some subtle continuity. And so I almost feel as though it's one of those places as well where to have the season kind of more planned out than they generally did for Star Trek, except for what they were going to do on Deep Space Nine, that would have been smart for this to show to actually pick up, because it's when you think about it, this is the show that probably should have the most continuity, because it's just one ship going from the next thing to the next, you know? And so what's really building this show should be the character dynamics, the characters themselves. And that should really be kind of the crux of this series. And yet, you know, it'll be interesting to see if that really happens. But again, you know, I think they had the right mindset in this episode that, okay, we need to see what this dynamic is going to be between this captain and this first officer who have been thrown together. We also need to see what this dynamic is going to be with these characters finding themselves thrust into positions of authority that they may have never thought themselves to be in. Because, you know, B'Elanna is not the only one dealing with that. The doctor is also still dealing with that whole idea as well. And so, you know, again, this is the part of the episode is kind of doing a good job of mirroring between the different characters, the stories that they're telling, the thematic element. And it's being hit from different perspectives, but it's all building into a cohesive whole. And as it's doing that, when it's really focused on the characters instead of, you know, kind of the science techno babble part of the story, that's the stuff that's really, really interesting, I think, in the episode. And the thing that, you know, as I'm watching this, I'm thinking, and I'm kind of putting myself back when this season came out, I'm thinking like, oh, this, that is some really interesting stuff dynamically I hope that continues. And as we go back through this, you know, I haven't seen this show since I think 2005, I said, in the first episode. So that's going to be the interesting thing kind of to chart throughout, especially this first season, is like, what are those dynamics sticks around, and how do they actually deal with those dynamics? And is it enough, or do they, like you were saying earlier, do we see it kind of go away too soon and we just, you know, kind of dive into what so many fans would get frustrated with Star Trek in general, which was just feeling like it became so rote and so routine instead of dynamic, which, again, that's the thing that, because nobody had their eyes on Deep Space Nine, they got to do.
So. Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So we'll see as we go through each episode how it really plays out versus memory. I've seen the series more recently than you, so I have my certain memory of how things play out, but that could be a bit fuzzy. The conflict's on full display in this episode, though. And before we talk about that, you're mentioning continuity, and I was thinking, Voyager gets in so many scrapes along the way. Wouldn't it have been great if the chief engineer had been named Cooter? And no matter what happened to the ship, when they come back from commercial, the hull is fine, everything's fixed, just like the General Lee on the Dukes of Hazzard. So,
I mean, that is one of the problems of the show. In general, my recollection of Voyager is the fact that, you know, the ship basically comes back better than when it left, which seems ridiculous. So, you know, yes, that's that is definitely a problem I remember in this show.
So back to the conflict element, though, the episode opens with Carrie having been punched in the face by B'Elanna. He's bloody nose. So the conflict is all there. We've still got B'Elanna acting kind of like an angry teenager at this point, which is something that does settle down pretty quickly. But we saw it in Caretaker as well. And part of the purpose of this episode is to get B'Elanna into the role of chief engineer, which is what she was supposed to be in from the start in terms of the concept of who the crew would be on the ship. But they needed to establish everything in Caretaker. They decided it would be just too much going on if they put that element into the pilot as well. So they moved it to this episode, which I think was a really great idea, because not only does it give B'Elanna her real introduction as a character, and we get to see the dynamic she has with Chakotay, with Janeway, with Carrie, others around her, but it also, through her and the exchange that we see between Seska and other Maquis and Chakotay at the beginning, you know, we really get to get this glimpse of the initial feelings that everyone has of being together. And I did want to mention about Chakotay before we get into B'Elanna and Carrie and all this. When he shuts down the Maquis' suggestion that they would be there if he wants to take over the ship, I think they do a good job of establishing Chakotay as a leader. So he's not happy about the situation. I don't think he's comfortable sharing authority with Janeway here necessarily. But like you said earlier, he understands the situation. He knows they're going to have to work together. And he kind of swallows his own pride or view of what he would prefer to do himself, largely because, again, you know, he's a graduate of the Academy. He's Starfleet. He has Starfleet command experience. So he knows, well, okay, we're in this situation. She's the captain. I'm going to be the first officer. My role is to watch over the crew, deal with the personnel. And then the way that he deals with B'Elanna and the way he deals with Janeway to help her see the potential that B'Elanna has to help the ship, I thought was well written and also well portrayed by Robert Beltran. And also related to this, you know, the title of the episode, this episode had a couple of titles as it was being developed. I think the first one was Ghost Ship, which makes sense in terms of there being another ship. But they settled on Parallax. And what I like about the title is, of course, it very clearly represents the two ships, especially because they're facing opposite directions, but also, you know, parallax between the positioning of our eyes is what allows us to see in three dimensions. And Chakotay has this one view of B'Elanna, and Janeway has this other view of B'Elanna. But when you pull them together, I think, especially for Janeway, she's able to see B'Elanna as a more well-rounded character the way we see the world in three dimensions, thanks to the parallax effect. So I think the title suits the story very, very well because it captures not only the literal obvious situation that they're in, but also the character development.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think I do want to piggyback off what you said about Robert Beltran and there as Chakotay. I think he actually comes off in this episode as being an incredibly interesting character, one that I really want to explore more of, especially since I think he is really been put into a position that is incredibly difficult. And of course, learning that he had graduated from the academy and everything, that's also really fascinating. I think that there's a lot to this guy. The way in which, you know, he, regardless of his internal feelings, he is the first officer through and through. I think that's great. And, you know, very much on Janeway's side, yet behind closed doors, willing to do what a first officer is supposed to do, right? Which is to challenge the captain, to give them another perspective, to help them see things that maybe they're not seeing. All of that, I think, is really great. And so I actually really enjoy the character building there for him. And then of course, like you said, just even with his dynamic, you really do get this sense that he and B'Elanna have been through a lot together, and they have a very close relationship. And in some ways, it feels like he's her other older brother. And I love that too. But then, like you said, just the way in which the title really speaks to the fact that if we're going to bring these two crews together, Janeway and Chakotay have to be the people who are working closest together to help each other see things from the perspective, like what you said, instead of seeing myopically, they're going to be able to see dynamically. They're going to be able to see in 3D, right? They're going to have depth perception that they wouldn't have if the other one wasn't there. And again, this is the thing that the episode, I think, is just doing so well. When we talk about the promise of Voyager from the first episode and what the show can do, this episode, I think, is doing a very, very good job of building that and saying, hey, this is what we can do on this show with these characters. And I really love that, you know, and again, getting to watch, you know, B'Elanna kind of grow through the episode and realize that there's going to be a lot that this character has to develop with, I think is fantastic. I think, though, and I don't know if you agree with this, but it almost feels like, and I get that we need some kind of scientific mystery or something that's going to help bring us together, but there's a part of me that almost feels like I kind of wish this episode hadn't had any science, technobabble, anything in it. It had just been about this crew trying to find a way to come together, and I think that would have been a real stretch for them to say, okay, actually space is pretty empty.
Yeah.
So we don't need to run into anything. In fact, the thing we need to do the most is run into the problems that we have between one another. And I think that would have been really interesting to me to see them find a way to have the same result with the characters, but not have to go through this kind of, you know, it's not forced, but it's just, it's the trope of Star Trek in some ways. Yeah. And so I don't know if they could have even done it. I think they could have done it really well. I think it would have been really interesting because the scientific mystery, it becomes so technobabble heavy that it does start to take away from the thing that's actually really working in the episode in the first place.
Well, this episode, the teleplay was done by Brandon Braga. And remember that this was written in the same general time period as All Good Things and Generations. And this the technobabble that got involved in Star Trek at that time was becoming a bit much, right? And so I'm not surprised that that bleeds into this episode as well, because it feels like Star Trek of this time period, right around the mid-90s, when this was, all of those things were being written, is sort of a staple of Star Trek at that point. I was, as you were describing that, I was picturing a Star Trek series. Let's say it's a seven season series, but they only run into something in space once per season. And the that's it. Yeah. So when you talk about the stories, like fans get together and talk like, oh yeah, you remember season four? You remember the one episode where they ran into this anomaly?
Yeah. Exactly.
And then the other 25 episodes are, it's just black around the ship all the time. Like they never just run.
They're playing in the holodeck.
Yeah. It's like, know, The Void is not an episode, but it's the season itself, right?
Yeah. You talking about the way in which the technobabble kind of became such an overriding thing in Star Trek. The interesting part about that is that, you know, we have the juxtaposition between the series which took the character route and the one that takes the tropey science technobabble route. And what I'm saying here is that I think the beauty of this episode is it really does show you that Voyager's characters are interesting enough. The storylines are good enough. And when written and focusing on the characters in those relationships and the dynamics, that's the core of the series. And again, as we go through this first season, it's going to be really interesting. Do we find ways to really lean into that? Or do we kind of find ourselves on the other side of the fence where it's like, this could just be any episode in The Next Generation. And, you know, it just, the thing we're saying is, I think we want Voyager to lean into the things that only Voyager can do. And there are going to be plenty of places where they do that throughout the series. That's going to happen. But do they kind of hit the easy button more often than not?
You mentioned the other side there. I thought you were going to break out into some Red Hot Chili Peppers for a minute for our soundtrack to to The Journey. So, yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. I think in this story, I think the scientific mystery that they're faced with is very important for this story, because it is the thing that brings B'Elanna and Janeway together. And I think it's the thing that really helps Janeway see insights and the value and the potential in B'Elanna beyond her temper tantrums.
Right.
Because she's able to connect with B'Elanna on this scientific engineering level, which is a language that Janeway understands. And she can look beyond the other things that are going on with B'Elanna, and she can really see that. And then from B'Elanna's side also, I think she sees Janeway just as this, she's the Starfleet captain. She's going to try to control us because she's the captain of the ship. But because of the situation they're put in, B'Elanna is actually able to see Janeway in a different light as well. And all that is made possible because the two of them are stuck out there in that shuttle trying to figure out the solution to this. So I'm not sure that, as good as the overall character elements are in this episode, I'm not sure that the real goal of the character development in this episode could have been achieved without this kind of scientific mystery. Now, I don't know if the technobabble needs to be quite as much as it is here. I think that you can tell this kind of story and you can help people understand the concept without getting into the wild technobabble.
I mean, when you actually have to have a character in the episode go, am I making any sense? Yeah, and the other character goes, no.
Not really.
But that's the way it works with, and so it's almost like they're winking at the cameras like, yeah, we know this doesn't make any sense to you.
Right.
And it barely makes sense to us. Yeah. So, and I think there's a way to tell this same story, but to do it in a way that allows those scientific mystery thing to really come in and be less obtrusive to the more important part of the story and really dynamically allow then those characters to come together. Because I agree with you in the sense that they are using this mystery for all of those things to happen. And and so I think what I'm where I'm coming from is that I agree with you. They it's a good idea. I think it needed a little bit more finesse. You know, it needed a slight bit more subtlety and less like, like it just felt like, and maybe this was a part of this, the episode in general as well. And I think it's partly because of the way B'Elanna's being played at this point. And that's not her fault. Roxanne is just going off what the director's telling her to do. But I think there's almost like a real heightened sense for everybody here. Like everybody's playing everything too big.
Yeah.
And it's like, you just need to calm down. Just calm down, you know? And like, if you bring it down, like, you know, three more octave levels, it would probably, the story would play out a little bit better, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think it's easy to overplay things in the first few episodes of any series, right? Because you're not only are the actors trying to find the characters, but the directors don't know who the characters are yet either. So, and even the writers don't know who they are.
No, 100%. And that's something where, you know, the characters that feel right here, again, Tom Paris, completely him, right? And you start to get that whole dynamic between him and Kes.
Well, that's that Nick Locarno effect.
So, yeah. So he's kind of played that character for. Again, I actually think that Robert Beltran and Kate Mulgrew are right on target with their characters.
Yeah, for sure.
I think, you know, Tim Russ is perfect right now as Tuvok. He's doing a great job. It does feel like you have a lot of the kind of younger crew members that are just a little bit just too amped up. And they what they needed probably was this director to say, okay, that's a good take, but what I need you to do is I need you to just dial that back by like a third.
Yeah.
And I think it would have helped. So,
yeah. I mean, Neelix, you know, he's just like right off the bat, mansplaining everything to Kes. It's like,
yeah, he is. Yeah, he is.
The Event Horizon.
I mean, she didn't know what it was, but the way he says it, it's like, yes, you're an idiot. And of course, the hard thing about her character, too, is like they only live 9 years. And so we kind of have no idea where she is in her mental development because, like, we've never met a species that develops that quickly. And then, you know, like basically has the longevity of like a Pomeranian.
Right. I just thought it was funny within the context of Star Trek that you've got a character, a main character, who's just literally mansplaining things to his girlfriend. Like, okay.
So,
I was going to mention, though, about the characters. So even Brandon Braga commented that he wrote the teleplay, he wrote the characters without really knowing how the actors were going to portray the parts because it's so early on. And so, I think it's easy to overplay stuff. Now, you talked about subtlety. One thing that does require subtlety when you discuss is shrinkage.
It was cold!
Right? Maybe it was cold in sick bay, or maybe the singularity was affecting the systems, but the Doctor experiences shrinkage in this episode. He even talks about how much, like right down to the millimeter, which is maybe a little too much information, Doctor, but what did you think about having this humorous storyline inserted into what's otherwise a serious and kind of intense episode? And maybe this could have been the problem that B'Elanna and Janeway bind over to solve on the ship instead of having the big external scientific technobabble mystery.
Yeah, I mean, I loved this story, actually, and it's not because of the humor, but they actually, I think, do such a great job of dealing with the reality of they don't have a doctor, and nobody's thinking about the fact that nobody's from medical in this staff meeting. And so it would really help if the doctor was there, because, you know, he might actually have an opinion on what's happening and what's going on with the crew. It might be good for him to know. And so that's the, and I agree with you, and I think you actually pinpointed it, the mystery of something going wrong with the holographic doctor, and that really being the impetus for this, you know, race of and contest of who's going to be the chief engineer would be great. And part of that is because if this doctor goes offline, we don't have a doctor. And right. That could be catastrophic for this crew who is 75 years from home, 70 years from home.
We might find out that Neelix has yet another talent that he hasn't shared with us yet. I do amazing things with gauze.
So, I really enjoy that. I think, obviously, Robert Ricardo does a fantastic job with the whole thing. I love the way it also allows us to kind of have that beginning relationship between the Doctor and Kes. It has the great dynamic between Paris and the Doctor. The fact that we start this whole thing about whether or not the Doctor has a name that we'll never give him, which is really dumb. But I really do think you pinpointed it. This could have actually been the mystery, and it could have had something to do with the fact that with the fight with the Kazon and, you know, what happened with the array, something's happened to the holographic grid, and if we don't get this back, and that's an easy fix for the, I think, a maybe even better story, that it really allows us to focus on all the things that we were focusing on without kind of the external technobabble nature to it. So what did you think of this story? Did you think it was a good insertion here? Or?
Yeah. Well, I remember when this first aired, I chuckled a bit, and I also thought it's kind of silly to have this going on, because it's such a, it's kind of a very juvenile humor of like,
it
he's
is.
Just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking on the display.
Especially the way it's played.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, like you say, like if this is being caused by some sort of damage resulting from the encounter with the caretaker and the destruction of the array and such, that would have made perfect sense as an element of continuity from episode to episode, and given them an internal problem to solve, which is what we would get on Deep Space Nine with the station, right? It's always something internal that's going on, which allows us to focus even more on the characters and not get into the like a typical Star Trek situation like we would have seen on The Next Generation.
Well, it makes the problem important, but it makes the focus the most important thing, which is the characters, you know? And that's kind of the, this is going to be the way in which the series is always going to have this give and take, which is Star Trek about the human condition, or is Star Trek about the adventure? And it's supposed to be both, but that the adventure helps us explore the human condition, and do they get that balance right is really going to be the thing that I think we'll talk about a lot throughout Voyager. But here, you know, for the most part, I think they do a good job. So one thing we didn't talk about last week, because again, we were doing we got a long episode that we had there, and we could have gone even longer
setup for the series as well last time. So, yeah.
But I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on the Jerry Goldsmith theme, because obviously, the original series, you have Alexander Courage. Then you've got The Next Generation, which just uses Jerry Goldsmith's theme from the motion picture, but reworked a little bit. Deep Space Nine, Dennis McCarthy comes in, does that theme. And of course, we get it twice with slightly different variations of that. They woo Jerry Goldsmith back here, though, for Voyager to create the main opening theme. And I've got to ask you, what do you think of that?
Yeah, well, obviously his connection to Star Trek prior to this was very important.
I mean, I think you could say it was legendary at this point.
I mean, you know, it's Goldsmith's done so much, but for me anyway, as a Star Trek fan, I always associate him with Star Trek. You know, he's just central to Star Trek. And this theme in particular, I always loved from the moment I heard it. Voyager premiered when I was in university. I was towards the end of university, but, you know, I was a music major in university. I'm classically trained. I played for years in a symphony orchestra, and I play bass trombone. And the melody in here and the brass parts in here always connected with me. And I can remember being in university and in the university wind ensemble before rehearsal would start, everyone sitting in kind of warming up. And it was very popular, especially with the horn players playing riffs off of DS9 and Voyager as part of a warm up. And so this theme always connected with me. I think that the collaboration from the music side and the visual side is also really excellent in the opening sequence. Kind of the visuals playing off of what they're hearing in Goldsmith's theme. And then the overall melody and the journey, what this is to the journey, right? The journey that the music takes you on, I think perfectly captures the focus of the series, this trip of Voyager having to get back from 70,000 light years away. And even the way that it wraps up, Goldsmith successfully balances that feeling of hope that you're going to get back, and also that feeling that we're not quite sure where we're going, because it does feel like it's this very open-ended journey.
The most interesting thing to me is that, you know, the Star Trek Voyager theme is legitimately one of the best pieces of Star Trek music. It's a gorgeous theme. And I think you did such a good job of laying out as to why it is, because of how well it fits the series. I think their use of his work from the motion picture in The Next Generation also really just fit that sense of Star Trek. Part of that is because we had already heard it before.
Yeah, that helps.
But here, he created something very unique. Now, at the same time, I think Dennis McCarthy had done the same thing for Deep Space Nine in that lone French horn that you have for the first three seasons at the beginning, where you have this sense of being out in space in this singular place that makes you feel kind of remote and out there, right? Great job. And I think, you know, it's one of the things that just overall, a lot of composers seem to have lost the ability to create themes to which immediately bring you into the headspace of whatever it is you're in. You know, you think of, obviously, John Williams' ability with Star Wars, Jaws, Indiana Jones, Jurassic Park, Harry Potter, right? Like, he created the sound of the world of Harry Potter. The moment you hear that music, you immediately are transported there. And that's what the Star Trek themes did. And I think that's what they kind of miss in, say, like Picard or something like Strange New Worlds, where I need that theme to truly transport me into the world of that show. And that's something that's lost over, you know, just you think of just the idea of television themes have been lost in general anyway. I mean, whether it's a pop song being used that comes to define a show like in Friends or you know, something thematic like Suicide is Painless from MASH, you know, like, right. It just and that's the thing that Goldsmith does like none other for this show. And it's just an incredibly beautiful theme. I love hearing it. I love, you know, the Star Trek themes. When you're watching the series, a lot of times I just watch the opening credits because of that. With the newer shows, I tend to just kind of like skip it because it just, it's missing that like it factor, you know, which is also interesting because they didn't even try on Star Trek Picard. Season three, you know, they just kind of cut that out all together. And so, Yeah, I got to give it to Goldsmith. He just absolutely nails this one. He knocks it out of the park. And regardless of how the rest of the show goes, the theme alone was worth the fact that we have this show, if you ask me.
Yeah. I think part of it, what you describe with Picard, for example, and other TV shows these days, I think part of it is just how times have changed. You see it not only in dramas like this, but think about, you mentioned MASH, but think about other sitcoms. Think about how through the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, shows had theme songs. Everybody knew the theme songs. But shows don't have theme songs anymore, right? They're just, they're right in. Opening sequences are really short.
Well, that's because you've only got like 12 minutes because you've got, you know, 45 minutes of commercials. 45 minutes of
commercials,
so,
right?
Yeah.
You know, but the whole approach has changed, and it's quite noticeable that the art of the theme song is gone. Like, you don't hear it. I'm not going to say you never ever hear one, but it's not like it used to be where that was the image that was tied to a particular show for everybody.
Well, I think that I'm trying to think of most recently, and honestly, it's the shows that you get on Premiere and Prestige television, you know, but I think of the last show that gave me an incredibly iconic theme that built you into that world was like Game of Thrones.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've ever heard that theme, you're like, oh, this absolutely kind of has the sound. And not only that, but it's like, then the visuals that they used in the opening credits, everything worked together to really tell you the story kind of this world. And that's the kind of thing where it's like, I feel like we kind of are missing that in so many of the shows. Mm-hmm. You know, I think in some ways, a lot of shows went the House of Cards route where it's like this, I don't know, it's all this movement on screen and it's all this really slick, you know, work done. And it just, there's just something that's missing. And it, and for shows like, say, Star Trek Picard, or I think, you know, even Star Trek Strange New Worlds, it's like you kind of want something vibrant that makes you kind of connect with the character. Like, the loss you get in Star Trek Picard is that theme should be the theme of Picard. And if you want to do that, what you really should have done is you should have pulled out the inner light and reworked that into the theme of Picard. Yeah, right. Anyway, so
well, that's something that you find missing a lot these days. If you think back to John Williams in particular, but composers of movies of that time period, they're really good at building themes for characters. You think of Princess Leia's theme in Star Wars, for example.
Yep.
And you don't hear that as much these days. You think, we're talking about Jerry Goldsmith, go to Star Trek V, think of the Klingon theme, which then gets picked up.
Exactly.
And whenever we see Worf down the road, Klingons on Deep Space Nine, you know, that we're picking up Goldsmith's Star Trek V, whatever people want to say about that movie, it's one of the best soundtracks of any Star Trek film. I mean, an incredible soundtrack. And if you don't have it, go get it. It's fantastic.
I listen to it so much, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. And same with Goldsmith, you know, the First Contact theme perfectly encapsulates the entire message of that movie in the opening with those blurred credits. Go back, Cliff Eidelman, the opening to The Undiscovered Country.
Yes.
You know, it's fantastic. Yes. And the person, and of course we shouldn't forget James Horner.
Oh my gosh. His work on Star Trek 2 and 3 is incredibly iconic.
Is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, for me, the composer who comes closest in recent years to capturing this stuff is probably Michael Giacchino, but I still think Goldsmith and Eidelman and Horner, those are, and of course John Williams for things outside of Star Trek. That's what you really need for stuff like this. Yes.
Oh man, if they could have pulled in Williams for a Star Trek soundtrack, would have been really interesting. I think it would have been so much fun.
Yeah,
but I'm really interested though. again, this is interesting because as we're diving into the show, we're finding ourselves with slightly longer episodes right now, and mm-hmm. and with all of that we talked about with this one, the things we liked, the things we didn't like, all that kind of stuff. I am really interested to see what you're going to rate this episode.
Mm. Okay, yeah, I have a great rating for this one. I think. I mean, I've really given it a lot of thought. But before that, just my final thoughts on the episode. I think that they're trying to do a lot in the second episode, and they found a premise that, you know, allowed them to build around it. Like I said, I think the mystery of the two ships and the singularity are necessary for the character connections that we get with Janeway and B'Elanna. And even though they're trying to do a lot here, and I think they effectively convey the sense of conflict and mistrust between the two sides, particularly the Maquis side looking at the Starfleet side, I think they also effectively gave us a smaller character story where we really get to see Janeway, Chakotay, and B'Elanna. Just these three. And B'Elanna is the linchpin to the relationship between Janeway and Chakotay becoming stronger. And so I think this was a tough task for them in this episode, but I think that Braga in particular doing the teleplay, you know, based on the story, which was written by Jim Trombetta, who, apart from this episode of Voyager, his work on Star Trek was on DS9. He did 5 episodes on DS9. And I think that also made him a good choice here. I mean, they picked up the story and they developed it. But I think choosing his story to build on when you needed to really work on characters early in the series, the fact that he primarily worked on DS9 is a strength there. So overall, I think the episode was really good, and I'm going to give this one 4 runny noses, 2 stubbed toes, and a pimple on a cheek.
Oh, man, that's great.
So how about you, Matthew?
Yeah, I think this episode, there's just so much to really like about it. I think actually, as I was watching this episode, and the beauty is, I think it's helpful that I haven't seen the series in so long, and so mm-hmm. in some ways, it's almost like coming to it fresh. And the way the episode deals with the promise of Star Trek Voyager, with this character development that they're doing and the drama that they've got going on, I think is really good. And I really liked this episode. And yet, for the things we said about it, it's not quite 4 out of 5 stars, but I think it's probably like 3.75. So it's basically the size of the Doctor by the end of the episode. It's 3.75 stars out of 5, or 3.75 inches is about the size of the Doctor.
Okay.
There you go.
I was going to say, so you're rating like if Doctor were full height, you're about where.
There you go.
Okay. I got it.
Anyway,
that rating, everyone.
Visualize that rating. There you go. But no, I was just surprised coming back into this episode, and it makes me excited to continue on the journey. So,
yeah. Well, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts as you continue on the journey with us. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's a closed group. It's designed just for listeners to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll see a post on the timeline there for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. Of course, you can also send us email if you prefer. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact, and use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose to the journey, and that'll come right through the singularity to Matthew and me. And you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not smacking things into ice until it buckles, where can people find you?
Well, ow, ooh, that hurt. You could find me all over the place on social media under the name Matt Rushing 02. Of course, here on the network, you'll find me in the 602 Club talking about all those franchises outside of Star Trek that we love. And, of course, a lot more Star Trek talk with Chris over on The Orb, Warp 5, Artificial Tango we did, of course, and Saddle Up, which we're excited at some point, Strange New Worlds will be coming back. And then, of course, you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network with two shows. One is completed, called Owlpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and then talking about Star Wars on Aggressive Negotiations with the great John Mills. Chris, when you're not struggling with height issues because of some sort of holographic projector problem, where can people find you?
Okay, that's the reason. Okay, I thought you were making a reference to my age and how I'm becoming a little bit shorter as I get older, like we all do.
No, Chris, we're both getting old. Have you seen all the gray hair that I have these days?
All right. You can, of course, find me, as you mentioned, here on the network, talking about Star Trek with you on various shows. And you can also find me on social media. I'm on all the platforms. Blue Sky is where I'm most active these days, but I'd love to chat with you wherever you are. So just drop me a line there. And if you'd like to help us keep this rewatch and all the rewatches and the other shows that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help to find out how to support the network. Just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. It does take a great deal of money to produce and distribute these shows, and we would not be here without your help. So thank you to everyone who's supporting us right now. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we get displaced together to talk about Time and Again.
Well, Chris, I don't remember whether it's Time or Again, but I guess set course for home.